I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
This is Religion Today with Martin Tanner, a weekly look at religion and spirituality here at home and around the world. Now, here's your host, Martin Tanner.
Welcome. This is Religion Today. I'm your host, Martin Tanner. Today's episode of Religion Today focuses on a recently released Netflix movie, Murder Among the Mormons. This has generated quite a bit of controversy and a great deal of interest. The reason that this episode of Religion Today focuses on the film is because I have more than just a casual interest in the subject matter. I know a number of the people who were featured in the film, and I know quite a bit about the background and events that are described in this documentary. There are some things about the film that I like, some things I find sensationalistic and a bit misleading, among which might be the title, Murder Among the Mormons. To me, it's a bit misleading. A more accurate title might be Murder Among the Mormons by a Closet Atheist, or maybe if you're offended as an atheist by that title, how about How a Forger Murdered to Try to Cover His Tracks, or something like that. Those would both be closer to the truth. This film was directed by Jared Hess, who directed the Napoleon Dynamite film from a couple of decades ago, and by Tyler Mason, who directed An Honest Liar, the documentary about the amazing James Randi, which I thought was quite fascinating. Let's talk about the subject matter of this film. I wanted to go through this in chronological order. I think it'll give you a better background than some of the clips in the film itself. Mark Hoffman is a subject matter. He's the murderer. Mark Hoffman was born, he's just a little older than I am. We both would have graduated from high school the same year. He went to Olympus High School in Salt Lake City. I went to Skyline. We both had mutual friends, but I never met Mark Hoffman. He was born in Salt Lake City, but by the age of 14, apparently decided that he did not believe in God. He decided, for whatever reason, to go on an LDS church mission. He was called to England. For much of his time there, instead of proselyting, he spent hours looking books, trying to find valuable documents, and reading books and pamphlets critical of the LDS faith, including Fine and Brody's hatchet job biography of Joseph Smith, No Man Knows My History, which, in my opinion, is perhaps the worst methodologically done biography I've ever read. You have to think that the author is somehow a mind reader to believe it's any good. All right, after Hoffman returned from his mission, he enrolled at Utah State University and got married in 1979. The very next year, in 1980, Hoffman said that he found a 17th century King James Bible with a folded up piece of paper inside. What Hoffman left out was that he had forged the paper, folded it up, and put it inside. And what was the forgery? It was based on the description of Professor Charles Anton that he had publicly given of the document Martin Harris brought to his office for identification, the Anton transcript. Although a fake, this appeared to most of the people who looked at it to be genuine and an important find. Dean Jesse, an LDS expert on documents written by Joseph Smith, thought Hoffman's forgery was probably genuine. He wasn't the only one. Harvard professor Barry Fell, for example, who's not a Latter-day Saint, also thought Hoffman's find was genuine, and Professor Fell even claimed to have deciphered it. Dubbed the Anton transcript, even though it differed from other known copies of the Anton transcript, copied from the Golden Plates, the LDS Church decided to purchase this Hoffman document on October 13th of 1980. Now, after successfully selling this forgery of the Anton transcript, Hoffman decided, this worked out pretty well for me. And he dropped out of Utah State University to go into business as a rare book and documents dealer. During the next few years, Hoffman, undetected, forged a number of documents, and his reputation for finding rare items increased in the LDS community and elsewhere. By this time, Hoffman had figured out that if he forged documents which embarrassed the LDS Church, he would generate more publicity, more interest, and increase his reputation, and also make more money. It didn't seem to matter to him that his forgeries were causing some people to doubt what they believe they knew of early LDS Church history. That brings us to 1981 and a document that Hoffman forged called the Joseph Smith III Blessing. Hoffman said he found a letter which showed Joseph Smith had designated his son Joseph Smith III and not Brigham Young as his successor to lead the LDS Church. Hoffman forged a cover letter, supposedly by Joseph Smith's scribe Thomas Bullock, in which Brigham Young is chastised by Bullock for having all the copies of the Joseph Smith III blessing destroyed. So, in essence, this Hoffman forgery intends deliberately to make Brigham Young look bad, like he's trying to suppress the true successor to the church and make himself a legitimate successor, and also that the church itself was complicit in this. And neither of these things were true. This is all bogus. This all came from Hoffman's mind. Hoffman got both the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints interested in this forged Joseph Smith III blessing. The next day, the New York Times headline read, "Mormon document raises doubts on succession of church's leaders." This is how Hoffman did it. Hoffman realized the power of his forgeries. About this time, he decided to produce his next significant forgery, the so-called Salamander Letter. In 1984, Hoffman forged this document, now known as the Salamander Letter, a letter supposedly written by Martin Harris to W.W. Phelps. Instead of Joseph Smith being employed by Josiah Stoll to help Stoll dig on his property where Stoll thinks there's buried treasure, in this bogus letter, Joseph Smith is described as using magic to try to find buried treasure. Instead of the angel Moroni appearing to Joseph Smith to eventually give him the golden plates, there's a white salamander that appears to Joseph Smith in this bogus letter. And the white salamander says he's going to give Joseph Smith the access to the golden plates if Joseph Smith conjures up the spirit of his dead brother, Alvin. The salamander letter was purchased by a gentleman, a church member named Steve Christensen, and donated to the church. This was when I first became really aware of Mark Hoffman and his Find the Salamander letter. The contents of this supposed Martin Harris letter seemed so odd and so bizarre to me that I just flat out doubted it could be true. Even some critics of the church found the Salamander letter to be questionable. I was far from alone in my uncertainty about its genuineness. No one's sure how many different documents Mark Hoffman forged during this time period in the early 80s, but they included a number of different documents. A letter from Joseph Smith's mother, Lucy Mack Smith, describing the origin of the Book of Mormon. Letters from Martin Harris and David Whitmer, each giving a personal account of their visions. A contract between Joseph Smith and E.B. Grandin for printing the first edition of the Book of Mormon. Two supposed pages from the original Book of Mormon manuscript dictated by Joseph Smith to Oliver Cowdery. And a number of other things. There was, in 1983, an additional forgery. Hoffman sold a fake letter supposedly written by Joseph Smith to Josiah Stoll, in which Joseph Smith purports to say he had been treasure hunting and practicing magic for several years after his first vision. This forgery was authenticated by Charles Hamilton, who was one of the foremost experts in the U.S. on American autographs at the time. This is how Hoffman did it. He got other experts to say his stuff was legitimate. All right, when we come back, more about Hoffman, how evil he was, and about the damage that he did. Why? Because I want you to know the real story and get a little bit more of an accurate version of what happened. Stay tuned. I'm Martin Tanner. This is Religion Today.
Religion Today with Martin Tanner continues on KSL News Radio 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
Welcome back. I'm Martin Tanner. This is Religion Today. If you have a question or comment about this program or any other program or just in general a religious question, feel free to send me an email. Send it to martinstanner@gmail.com, and I will be happy to respond. Today we're talking about a fascinating Netflix movie, one which in some ways I like, particularly towards the end, and I dislike, particularly towards the beginning, called Murder Among the Mormons, the title of which I don't particularly care for either. But it's out there. It needs to be discussed. So back to our story. And I'm trying to go through this chronologically so that it will make more sense. How, you might ask yourself, did Hoffman come up with all these forgeries, a virtual flood of important Mormon documents, and make it seem plausible that he'd found all these? Well, Hoffman said that he had this network of people that he had tracked down over the years, people who were descendants of early Latter-day Saints, people who had found collections of 19th century letters, people who had saved letters and postcards for their postmarks rather than their contents. In addition, and this was quite ingenious, Hoffman also traded in many legitimate historical documents that he acquired. And so, interspersed with all of his forgeries, he had the real McCoy in a lot of cases. And so, these legitimate documents, which were not questioned at all, bolstered his credibility. Now, Hoffman forged other documents in addition to the LDS stuff. He forged LDS documents, but Americana. He claimed to have documents that were signed and written by George Washington that were forged. John Adams, John Quincy Adams, John Brown, Daniel Boone, Mark Twain, Andrew Jackson, Nathan Hale, Abraham Lincoln, Paul Revere, and a whole bunch of others. He just forged all kinds of things. He even forged a supposedly unknown poem of Emily Dickinson. And that gets us to what is perhaps one of his most bold and daring forgeries that almost worked. There's a document called the Oath of a Freeman. It's a one-page oath that really was printed in 1639. It was the very first document, as far as anyone knows, to be printed in the American colonies. There are only about 50 printed one-page of these documents made. So 50 pages, that's it. And they were small. Nobody knew that any of them existed. They were thought to have all been lost. If found, one of them would have been worth well over $1 million back in 1985. Hoffman claimed to have found one and began to negotiate sale of it to the Library of Congress. If he had pulled that off, it would have been quite amazing. Despite the amounts of money that Hoffman had made from all of his document sales, he was in debt at this time, partly because of his lavish lifestyle, partly because of his purchases of genuine first edition and other rare books and documents. To pay his debts, Hoffman brokered this sale to the Library of Congress and also another deal of a supposed McClellan collection. Now, the McClellan collection, if you have not heard of it, was supposedly an extensive collection of documents written and assembled by early LDS apostle William E. McClellan, who eventually left the church. Hoffman said the McClellan collection was really valuable because it would make the church look bad. Hoffman apparently hadn't quite calculated and figured out ahead of time exactly how much time and effort and work it would take to forge such a massive amount of documents as it would take to create out of thin air McClellan collection. And so he needed more time. But he'd already told people that he had the McClellan collection. So how's he going to get more time? Well, Hoffman decides he's just going to kill a few people with bombs. On October 15th of 1985, his first pipe bomb killed document collector Stephen Christensen. Later the same day, a second pipe bomb created by Mark Hoffman killed Kathy Sheets, the wife of Stephen Christensen, who had just died, his employer. These hit close to home for me. My siblings knew the Sheets family very well. I knew them a little bit. I have a number of books in my own personal library that were owned and have the stamp of ownership of Stephen Christensen, who was killed. These people were wonderful, good people, and Mark Hoffman killed them. Hoffman wanted police and others to think the bombings were related to the business dealings of Gary Sheets and Steve Christensen. Since Steve Christensen had purchased the Salamander letter, thinking it was real, but it wasn't, and donated it to the church, Hoffman apparently thought he could hide out for a while if Christensen died and if somebody related to the Sheets family died, turned out to be the wife and mother. Hoffman figured that he'd be able to hang out and perhaps complete the McClellan collection. So the following day, Hoffman himself was severely injured when a bomb exploded in his car. Some people think Hoffman was trying to kill Brent Ashworth, who had unwittingly purchased a number of forgeries from Hoffman. Some think Hoffman was trying to commit suicide, which I personally doubt. During the investigations, police discovered forgeries in Hoffman's basement. They also found the engraving plates that were used to create the bogus Oath of a Freeman. Document examiner extraordinary George Throckmorton analyzed a number of Hoffman documents that had previously been deemed authentic and determined that they were forgeries. Three letters purportedly written from an Illinois prison by Joseph Smith had different ink and paper and instruments, which was really highly unlikely because, hey, how would you get all those different things in one prison cell? In addition to that, George Throckmorton found this cracked ink that was used in these forgeries. The cracking apparently happened when Mark Hoffman aged the ink artificially in several different ways. So Hoffman was arrested in January of 86, charged with four indictments and 27 counts, including first-degree murder, a whole bunch of other horrible things. Faced with the prospect of the death penalty, finally, Hoffman decided that he would enter into a plea bargain, which he ultimately did rather than going to trial. Hoffman confessed to a lot of what he did in open court. The complete details of what he did will probably never be known, and whether or not he told the truth about everything that he said is also, of course, up to question. One of the things that's fascinating to me is that you have somebody who's such a horrible person who caused so much chaos, and people were willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. That's tragic to me. After Hoffman was imprisoned, he was eventually excommunicated by the church. His wife filed for divorce, and Hoffman attempted suicide. Ironically, in connection with the suicide, his right hand was permanently disabled, so he could never forge anything eventually or ever again, even if he wanted to. In my opinion, by far the best synopsis and description of what happened, and the only one which properly and fairly presents what happened from the church's point of view, is the transcript of a talk given at BYU in August of 1987 by Elder Dallin Oaks. You can find it on the church's website right now. It's absolutely fabulous. The title is Recent Events Involving Church History and Forged Documents. It's absolutely excellent. It's very, very well done. The church and its leaders are sometimes unfairly presented as being misled and taken advantage of by Hoffman. The church and many of its leaders did have grave questions about whether documents acquired by Hoffman were legitimate. To its credit, in my opinion, the church acquired them anyway and made them available to investigators and the public. Those are the actions of an open and forthright church I'm proud to be a member of. Ultimately, Hoffman's most daring and difficult plan was apparently to forge, or attempt to forge, the lost 116 pages. In the end, justice was served. I hope you will join me again next week. I'm Martin Tanner. This is Religion Today.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.